And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I am Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing, Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And today we're going to be talking to Eve Engler about this, whether or not Canada hearts terrorism in places like Syria. We're also going to ask him his views on the Great Pipeline controversy. I bet you can intuit what he might be thinking. Later on, Phil and I are going to discuss the further fallout and ramifications of the great Hollywood film, notorious Hollywood film Argo. I finally saw it. I like to review them without seeing them, but this time I thought, well, you better get serious. It's very interesting. We'll get into that. And we're going to also, we have the statement from Fidel Castro on the death of Hugo Chavez. It's a complete text, and we're going to read that out. That would probably be about the halfway point. But first of all, we have a report from Thomas Mountain, who lives in Eritrea, and he is described always well as the most widely distributed independent journalist in Africa, living and reporting from Eritrea since 2006. And you can find his writings on the net, of course. But first of all, I want to read what Thomas has to say about an issue which impacts on Eritreans and others actually living in Canada as well. This is Thomas Mountain's report. On Sunday night, February 24, three Eritrean community centers in Stockholm, Sweden, were firebombed and burnt to the ground following a vicious attack on the Swedish Eritrean population by a program broadcast by Stockholm Television, SVT. The pogrom-style documentary was a clear message to racist elements in the Swedish community to attack the Eritrean community, one of the largest, best-organized, and nationalist African communities in Sweden. Racist firebombings in the capital, yet not one Swedish parliamentarian, human rights group, or religious organization has spoken out publicly to condemn these violent attacks. And what of the so publicly vociferous defenders of Eritrean human rights in Eritrea, such as Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch? A shameful silence, continuing both organizations' long history of such when it comes to really defending Eritrean human rights going back decades. The television program that sparked the firebombings was a one-sided rant that focused on the support Eritreans in Sweden have for their homeland, Eritrea. In particular, the voluntary 2% income tax all Eritreans pay to the government, a tax that has been critical in funding, amongst other programs, the human services that have made Eritrea one of the few countries in Africa on its way to meeting the UN Millennium Development Goals, programs that have helped Eritrea reduce malaria mortality by 80%, the biggest breakthrough in malaria mortality prevention in history. Programs that have led to a remarkable increase in longevity in Eritrea, according to the World Bank, certainly no friend of Eritrea. Programs that have brought real human rights to Eritreans in villages across the country, such as clean drinking water, medical clinics, and schools. Sweden, the UK, and the USA have all tried to block Eritreans supporting their homeland, threatening Eritreans publicly by paying their 2%, while trying their best to prevent the collection of such by the Eritrean embassies in the three countries. In the USA, Eritreans from all over the country have to find a way to pay their 2% in cash to the Eritrean embassy in Washington, D.C., due to the Obama regime's suppression of all bank accounts and remittance services by the Eritrean government in the USA. Eritreans have never been ones to take such attacks laying down, and this past weekend saw thousands of Eritreans gather from across Sweden to march through the bitterly cold streets of Stockholm to the Swedish parliament to protest these racist attacks. Yet still not a single Swedish media outlet found the time to cover this demonstration. One can only wonder what attacks lie in store for the Eritrean community in these so-called democratic, human rights-loving countries. As Eritrea continues to reject Western aid as it builds its economy, the fastest growing economy in Africa, and improve the lives of its people, all the while fighting off continued military invasions by the Ethiopian regime. The question of the right of Eritreans living abroad to support their country and its government will be a focus of the Western regime's frustration, and one would be well served by preparing for worse to come. Arbitrary arrest and detention under the guise of fighting terrorism, perhaps. Mass deportations. Eritreans experienced these crimes committed by the Western-supported Ethiopian regime in the late 1990s, and the world should start preparing itself for the possibility of a repeat of such in the so-called Western democracies. The one thing that can be counted on is the continued silence of those self-anointed defenders of human rights, such as Amnesty and Human Rights Watch. That's Thomas Mount, an important piece of news, I think. And I think we're joined now by Eve Engler. Are you there, Eve?
How's it going, Phil?
Not bad. Eve, I want to know what you have written extensively about the Canadian government, and particularly its role in being the sort of silent helper, silent partner, and a lot of bad things that the Americans do. And I want to know, with the crisis unfolding in Syria, there seems to be clear evidence that the elements crossing the border coming into Syria seem to have arms from the monarchies, and they seem to have the backing of Western intelligence. At the same time, we have a government in Canada that says it's against terrorism, acts of terror being carried out by these elements in Syria. So is Canada honest about opposing terrorism, or we just like some terrorists? Do we heart some?
I think it's pretty clear that their definition of terrorism is the terrorism that challenges Western dominance when Canadian troops or forces from other countries or rebel factions that are going in our direction. It's no longer called terrorism. So I think it's that's a long-standing kind of double standard. If you look at what the Israeli government does regularly, the Palestinians, the Harper government often cheerleads, and those are clear acts of terrorism. And in the case of Syria, the Canadian government is clearly hostile to Assad. Mm-hmm. Those who are fighting Assad are seen as benevolent actors, despite the fact that there is obvious clear Al-Qaeda ties and all kinds of different unsavory actors that are opposing the Assad government.
Mm-hmm. And this is Eve Engler. We want to. And what about? This is something I often ask you. And this seems to me we ought to all be contemplating. Where are other parties on these kind of matters? Because they're engaged in a process here, for example, of basically pulling the state identity of Syria out from under the existing government of Syria. And do you see how much difference of opinion do you see from the opposite benches in Parliament?
There's obviously very little difference of opinion. I don't see the NDP coming out particularly actively on this issue, or the different contradictions in Canadian policy vis-a-vis terrorism in general. I mean, you would never hear an NDP foreign affairs critic refer to Israeli terrorism, yet they would often refer to acts that are viewed as against Western forces as mm-hmm. as acts of terrorism, or again Western civilians or whatnot. But so the parameters of debate are narrow on the issue of Syria. The reality is, my perspective at least is that it's a pretty grim situation on all sides, and Assad is far from a force worth supporting, and the other side is far from a force worth supporting, and the different interests, the different Gulf monarchy interests, the Canadian-American interests, Hezbollah's position, if you like, the different mix. There's very little concern for Syrian civilians, and the majority of Syrians who are kind of caught in the middle of a pretty difficult situation. Adding guns to the mix or the like is not any way to improve things.
But wouldn't that be a starting point? But I want to just remind you, this is Eve Engler, and he has his latest book is The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy, and of course we're talking about whether or not Mr. Harper, pursuing an ugly policy, has any watchdogs, and apparently, as I understand your point, they seem to be sound asleep. In this matter of, well, who would you support, shouldn't there be an issue of, why don't we put this in a proper forum where we discuss what we're all doing? I mean, are we aiding and abetting people who are crossing the border and killing people? And why?
No, that would be, that's certainly the moral position is, how is Canada implicated in this, and where has some of that money that we're flowing in, right? Recently, you see that a bunch of money flowing to the Jordanians, ostensibly for Syrian refugees, which on the surface of it, could be a decent thing, obviously, if the money is actually going to Syrian refugees. But it's also tied into a geopolitics vis-a-vis the Jordanian monarchy, which is, I think, increasingly threatened by different forces, democratic forces that want to change in Jordan. But we in Ottawa, the government sees the Jordanian monarchy as a close ally, very close to Israel, obviously close to Washington. And so there's, a lot of support. There's obviously a free trade agreement that Harper signed with Jordan. So I think that's, the moral position, or the correct political position, would be to look at, are we enabling any of this killing? Not just to criticize the CIA training, which is now very clear, the CIA training different opposition factions. That doesn't mean that everything that Assad has ever done is great,
right?
But we control what we control, and the first rule should be to make sure you're not contributing to people's oppression and misery, and that's obviously not the way the dominant media in this country and most of unfortunately even the opposition parties, that's not the premise in which they come at things.
Yes, and by the way, you would think that the opposition, perhaps even the liberals, and we're going to get to Mr. Chrétien because you wrote about him in an article about what happened in Iraq, but that they would talk about where this might be worked out. And, for example, there have been Security Council meetings, and there have been Security Council agreements. There was a Geneva agreement, I believe it was a year ago, June. Well, not a year ago, last June, 12. And where they said, here's a formula. And there was some key element there, by the way. I mean, it was debated by major powers. And they said the two sides should meet without saying eliminating each other. In other words, the government would have to agree to meet with people who were trying to kill it. And the guys who were fighting the government would have to meet with the government without saying that the other guy has to step down. Now, that seemed to be a kind of a narrow point, and they argued over it, but they did agree that was the way to go. Now, why couldn't, where are our opposition parties saying, okay, we have a working document, why doesn't Canada help make that document work?
Well, that would obviously be a sensible position, but to start from that premise is part of it has to be, there's been so much glorification of the opposition in Syria in the dominant media. Mm-hmm. To imply differently, I mean, increasingly that that gloss is wearing off. The opposition is increasingly clear who they are.
They finally arrested an American soldier who was serving with the one that, according to the State Department, was in the nastiest bunch there is, and it turns out there's a former American soldier right in the middle of him, smiling.
Exactly. And from the standpoint of the opposition, in there were different rebel factions. So long as they're getting, you know, funding and weapons and training from the Gulf countries and Turkey and Washington, you know, they don't really have any interest in taking a position that's not Assad must go before there's any before there's any negotiations.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No.
In other words, they're getting a kind of a wink, right? We're bad terrorists. However, the check's in the mail, you can cash that check. It's still good, right? Even though they stand in front of the cameras and say they don't want to see jihadist terrorists. However, those groupings seem to be quite well funded. They're not running out of money. They seem to be actually the best funded in some ways.
Yeah, and that gets back to the kind of point about, is Canadian foreign policy what people sort of, what the commentators say it's about, which is, you know, helping poor people around the world and you know, enabling, you know, sort of good stuff. If you believe that's what it is, then you would think that that Canadian foreign policy would, you know, try to stop the violence. But if you think that it's really just about advancing geostrategic and corporate interests, then, you know, from Ottawa's perspective, you know, who cares if tens of thousands more Syrians die? It doesn't really, you know, affect us. We like the fact that this country is sort of destabilized. We like the fact that you know, Hezbollah is sort of weakened by this, and Iran's weakened by this. And I think there are still, you know, questions about. I'm not sure that Israel necessarily wants Assad to fall completely, and he's probably very worried about, you know, possibilities of who comes after. So I don't think it's a 100% all out effort, obviously, to get Assad to, you know, to overthrow Assad or to defeat Assad. But I think that there's clearly, from a geostrategic standpoint, there's lots of interest in weakening the regime there, you know, what happens to the most Syrians,
crippling
crippling the regime, and what happens to most Syrians is not of particular importance to the decision makers in Ottawa or Washington or elsewhere.
Just makes a nice picture on the front page. Suffering sells. This is Eve Engler, and he's the author of The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy, and recent Counterpunch. Eve has an article explaining to world readers, Counterpunch has big audience, that there's some misunderstanding about one of our opposition parties, called the Liberal Party, and particularly Jean Chrétien, who lately has seemed to have just risen suddenly like Lazarus. It turned on the issue of Canada's non-overt involvement in Iraq. But you explain that a very, very important point, and this should bear on the issue of Syria too, which is, remember the role of active Canadians who went into the streets by the thousands trying to stop that attack on Iraq. But could you enlarge upon that?
Yeah, I mean, on the just before the 10-year anniversary of the U.S.-led invasion, second invasion of Iraq, Chrétien went out and got himself onto a whole number of different media outlets, boasting about how he had had the foresight to keep Canada out of Iraq, and he never believed the idea of weapons of mass destruction, and that's why Canada didn't officially join the coalition of the willing that invaded Iraq. And whether Chrétien believed the American intelligence or not, I don't know one way or another, but I do know that the reason why Chrétien and the Liberal government didn't officially join the coalition of the willing had nothing to do with believing or not of the intelligence, but was to do with the fact that there were mass demonstrations, most importantly in Quebec,
yes.
And there was an upcoming election in Quebec that that they were nervous that supporting the invasion would boost the Parti Québécois' support in the election, and so they didn't join the coalition willing, but they did do a whole bunch of things to help the Americans. There's Canadian troops
backroom work
and kind of, you know, proving that it wasn't sort of like a moral opposition to the invasion, but it was more a political opposition. Public relations political opposition, if you like. And they, you know, supported, there was Canadian naval vessels patrolling off the coast. There was actually even legal opinion within the foreign affairs suggesting that Canada was legally at war with Iraq because of Canada's role in charge of a bunch of NATO naval vessels off the coast of Iraq. There was, you know, Canadian general that was in charge of tens of thousands of troops in Iraq, a couple of different generals, a whole series of different forms of support. And I kind of tie that into a longer history of how Canadian foreign policy has, how opposition groups or solidarity movements have been able to push decisions on Ottawa in terms of foreign policy decisions on vis-a-vis apartheid South Africa, for instance, and then the decision makers later sort of twist that history into being they sort of took a moral position.
Yeah, like they were leading.
they were leading the issue, and they fits into this whole sort of mythology of the benevolent Canadian foreign policy, which obscures the idea, obscures the fact that it's corporate and geostrategic interests that drive Canadian foreign policy overwhelmingly.
Mm-hmm. I'm very glad you wrote that article. I really urge people, go to Counterpoints, put Eve Engler and read the article. I know that the American population needs to see that. And everybody needs to be reminded that, yes, you can make a difference. And if you're waiting around for parliamentarians, well, you got a long wait. That was clearly my memory as well. That the demonstrations were as big as they had been, really, since Vietnam, practically. And in Quebec, they were massive. We really needed to be reminded. This is Eve Engler. His latest book is The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. Now, you've written about this major subject, which, by the way, it's front page every day. The pipeline, and the title is Pipeline Politics, A Canadian Angle. Could Harper's Government Be Derailed? It's in Counterpunch. I guess I'll throw up a headline today just to show this is kind of serious stuff. We had a report yesterday. There's been a spill in Mayflower, Arkansas. It has everybody pretty alarmed. And given the political tension around this, some people are afraid that might derail this matter. You want to address this? When you say the government might be derailed by this issue, how could that be?
Well, I think the Conservatives have just put so many of their eggs in the tar sands basket if there is prolonged price differential, which there is right now with the price of Canadian crude on the international market, and if that price differential gets bigger and the economics of pulling out the tar sands oil become worse because they can't get that oil to market either down south, which they obviously want with the Keystone XL, or over to the west coast with the Kinder Morgan and the Enbridge pipeline, Northern Gateway. This government, I think, is in trouble, and there's a possibility that they will. There will be a real backlash, even within the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. You raised the issue that they might have cornered themselves, or one expression is snookered themselves when they by taking such a hard stand on environmental issues. They and now they're dealing with an Obama government that did not take that position, they could be in a kind of a bind.
Yeah, no, and that's getting increasing. Even the, I don't know if you saw the pulling out of the drought convention about dealing with drought in Africa. I don't know if you saw a number of different commentators pointed out that that this is just, you know, there was a $350,000 I think Canada was giving to this.
They're running out of feet to shoot, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly, and they just, you know, by pulling out, they just further confirm in the minds of, you know, people paying attention to this stuff that they don't care about the environment whatsoever. And in the case of, you know, how much money they're spending in terms of lobbying for Keystone XL, let's just say $350,000 is not a significant sum in that mix, and it's just a real sort of embarrassment to them. But I think that this spill, which there's video of now circling around, I understand it's getting lots of traction. That's just one element to oppose these pipelines, or specifically the Keystone Pipeline. But really, the main issue is just the runaway climate disturbances and what that means for humanity. And the Harper government has shown that it just does not care about the long-term consequences for humanity. And they, you know, by pulling out a Kyoto Protocol, by lobbying just so aggressively in the U.S. and to me this issue of seeing how clearly the Harper government is in opposition to a social movement down south, this is unprecedented in the history of Canadian-American relations. You have a situation where the roles are reversed in terms of usually it's seen as Canada being seen as the more progressive outpost, and the U.S. being the more reactionary place. But this is a very clear example where you have the Canadian government so aggressive in support of the pipeline and spending millions, probably tens of millions of dollars of public money and lobbying for it. The Harper government has put themselves into a position now where I think they have alienated so much of the Canadian public. Their traditional base is obviously a very pro-American base, so I think there's not a whole lot of the electorate that they can of the Canadian electorate they can move away from or move towards, should I say. Their slice of the pie is pretty is probably about 35-40%. That's it. And if you combine Obama saying no, I don't see that Harper has much to respond with in terms of threatening or putting pressure on Obama. So I think that it's a very interesting dynamic to see the Canadian government so actively opposed to an American social movement. And hopefully, we know who Obama is. He's somebody, you know, way too close to Wall Street and other different interests. But hopefully the protest movement in the U.S. will be successful. And not only, you know, stop, put some dent in the tar sands juggernaut, but also hopefully provide a blow to Harper that helps Canadians get rid of this odious bunch.
Well, no, I think it's your book that's done the job. It's The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. Ever since that book came out, the guy's been in trouble. This is Eve Engler. One last question here. I wonder if you're agreeing with that thesis that is going on in the States. They say that the American Republican Party is having a lot of trouble. They seem to be in what they might call a survival mode, and the survival means they're going to embrace the nastiest portions of their party. And by survival, in other words, they're going to just be satisfied to have a 30% base that they can cling to for fear of being washed out totally.
Well, I think, Harper, there's certainly something going on with.
We're hearing all these rumblings about all of a sudden they want to fight abortion, probably going to have capital punishment pretty soon.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, there is to some extent it seems like the party internally is starting to rip apart, which Harper has obviously been very successful at keeping that together. But I think that's what, you know, one of the things you'll see is that if something like Keystone XL is, if there is a no and there's, you know, increasing gap in terms of the price margin, and those tensions within the party, I think will get more and more real. And I would assume you start having a bit more pushback from some manufacturing sectors in Ontario that have been hit by the mm-hmm. by the high dollar because of the focus on the on tar sands exports, and some break there. But I think there is a different dynamics than with the Republicans, and I think the Republicans, part of their issue is this: they've alienated all the non-white communities in the U.S. Just as those communities are becoming bigger proportion of the population, not a very smart electoral strategy.
Yeah, even when they try to fix it, all they do is reveal how dumb they are, how they don't even know what they're talking about.
And I think people like Karl Rove, who are try to move the party in a bit more of a, yeah. a rational direction, gets brought back by the most reactionary.
I think they've scared the hell out of Rove. I mean, he'd prefer to be a hippie, I think, than hang out with those guys. We may see Rove show up at Liberal parties.
That's a pretty bad state of affairs.
Yeah, certainly for the Liberals. Yeah. Eve Engler, it's always fun to talk to you. And boy, those are great articles. I urge everybody to go Counterpunch, but also get the book, The Ugly Canadian, Stephen Harper's Foreign Policy. Thanks very, very much.
Thanks, Adam.
See you. That's Eve Engler. And Eve always does great work. We admire it very much. And certainly just the pipeline piece I really recommend. But do look at this story out of Arkansas. Arkansas, let me just read you a paragraph. Exxon Pipeline leaks thousands of barrels of Canadian oil in Arkansas. Matthew Robinson, David Shepard, New York, Reuters, Exxon Mobil was working to clean up thousands of barrels of oil in Mayflower, Arkansas. You may take that as an omen. Gosh, we got troubles in Mayflower. After a pipeline carrying heavy Canadian crude ruptured, a major spill likely to stoke debate, yes, over transporting Canada's oil to the United States. Exxon shut the pipe, the Pegasus pipeline, that's a horse, right, which can carry more than 90,000 barrels a day of crude from Pocota, Illinois, I love the names, to Nederland, Texas. After the leak was discovered on Friday afternoon, the company said in a statement, Exxon hit with a $1.7 million fine by regulators this week over a 2011 spill in the Yellowstone River, said a few thousand barrels of oil had been observed. 1.7. I mean, sends chills, right? You can see the attorney general saying to Exxon, wrists will be slapped. We're going to slap a wrist here. Pinch your eyes, bite down on this. We're going to slap your little wrist. $1.7 million for dumping oil in the Yellowstone River. China, that would be capital punishment, I got to tell you. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back. We have Fidel Castro's statement on Hugo Chavez. This is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5. And we're back. It's the Taylor Report, CIUT. Actually, before I read this Fidel statement, Phil has, we want to make sure we remind people there's something going on at Betzatun tonight.
Right, tonight. The State of Democracy in Israel, how democracy works and doesn't work for Palestinians in Israel. And that is Dr. Jamal Sahalka, a Palestinian and a sitting member of the Knesset, which, of course, is difficult work for him, because he's sitting in a parliament where everybody thinks he shouldn't exist. That's Betzatun tonight, 7 p.m. So as soon as the Taylor Report's over, head out for Betzatun, 612 Markham Street. And also at Betzatun this week, opening on Thursday and running for 10 days, is a photo exhibit called The Photo Exhibition by Chad Evans Wyatt from the Roma Community Center of Toronto. There'll be a reception at 7:30. Prior to that, there'll be a panel discussion at 6 p.m., Thursday, April the 4th, at Betsa 2 and 612, Refugee Rights or Human Rights, and it's Canada's Refugee Rights Day from the Roma Community Center. So the emphasis will be on the Roma, and it'll be for a 10-day period, the 4th through the 14th, and the panel discussion is 6 p.m. on Thursday night, the 4th, Betsa 2 and 612 Markham Street. And that's a very important issue, one which we need to hear more about, and we congratulate Betsa 2 for bringing this up.
So. We're going to try to do more on the Roma in this program. So it's 7 o'clock tonight at
Betsa 2? 7 o'clock tonight, the State of Democracy in Israel, and 6 p.m. for the panel discussion and 7:30 p.m. for the opening of the art exhibit on Thursday, April the 4th.
Okay, thanks very much. this is Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. By the way, you can write us. Write to us, taylor@caut.fm, and check us out on the web at taylor-report.com. This is very important. I got it from Venezuela and VenezuelanAnalysis.com. It's full text, and I always believe Fidel has been now for decades the guy you want to go to, particularly in this hemisphere, to know about issues all over the world, but particularly South America. And, of course, we've had the tragedy of the loss of Hugo Chavez. And it goes this way. The leader of the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro, has described late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez as the best friend of the Cuban people have had in their history. Prensa Latina posts the full letter by Fidel Castro. And it goes, "We have lost our best friend. The best friend the Cuban people have had throughout their history died on the afternoon of March 5. A call via satellite communicated the bitter news. The significance of the phrase used was unmistakable. Although we were aware of the critical state of his health, the news hit us hard. I recall the times he joked with me, saying that when both of us had concluded our revolutionary task, he would invite me to walk by the Aracua River in Venezuelan territory, which made him remember the chance to rest that he never had. The honor befell us to have shared with the Bolivarian leader the same ideas of social justice and support for the exploited, the poor, or the poor in any part of the world. Let Venezuela give me a way of serving her. She has in me a son," proclaimed national hero Jose Marti, the leader of our independence, a traveler who, without cleansing himself of the dust of the journey, asked for the location of the statue of Bolivar. Marti knew the beast because he had lived in its entrails. Is it possible to ignore the profound words he voiced in an inconclusive letter to his friend Manuel Mercado the day before he died in battle? I am, quotes, this is Jose Marti, right? "I am in daily danger of giving my life for my country and duty, for I understand that duty and have the intention of carrying it out, the duty of preventing the United States from extending through the Antilles as Cuba gains its independence, and from falling with that additional strength upon our lands of America. All that I have done thus far and will do is for this purpose. I have had to work silently and somewhat indirectly because there are certain things which, in order to attain them, have to remain concealed." As close quotes, as Jose Marti, read by Fidel, quoted by Fidel Castro. Fidel continues, "At that time, 66 years had passed since the liberator Simon Bolivar wrote, the United States would seem to be destined by fate to plague the Americas with miseries in the name of freedom. On January 23, 1959, 22 days after the revolutionary triumph in Cuba, I visited Venezuela to thank its people and the government, which assumed power after the Perez Jimenez dictatorship, for the dispatch of 150 rifles at the end of 1958. I said at that time, Venezuela is the homeland of the liberator, where the idea of the union of the peoples of America was conceived. Therefore, Venezuela must be the country to lead the union of the peoples of America As Cubans, we support our brothers and sisters in Venezuela. I have spoken of these ideas not because I am moved by any kind of personal ambition or even the ambition of glory, because at the end of the day, ambitions of glory remain a vanity. And as Martí said, all the glory of the world fits into a kernel of corn. And so, upon coming here to talk in this way to the people of Venezuela, I do so thinking honorably and deeply that if we want to save America, if we want to save the freedom of each one of our societies, that at the end of the day are part of one great society, and which is a society of Latin America, if it is that we want to save the revolution of Cuba, the revolution of Venezuela, and the revolution of the countries on our continent, we have to come closer to each other, and we have to solidly support each other, because alone and divided we will fail. That is what I said on that day, and today, 54 years later, I endorse it. I must only include on that list the other nations of the world which, for more than half a century, have been victims of exploitation and plunder. That was the struggle of Hugo Chavez. Not even he himself suspected how great he was. Until victory forever, unforgettable friend, Fidel Castro Ruz. That was a statement he made on March 11, 2013. Those are two great figures. It was just amazing that their time coincided as it did, and Fidel was like a avuncular figure to Hugo Chavez. And we had Eve Engler on earlier talking about how parties here tend to just be in lockstep, and they tend to be rather uptight, Anglo, and lost. They're certainly indifferent to the world. And there was not adequate expression from this country of respect for the president of Venezuela, who had been elected four times by big majorities, whether anybody here likes it or not.
When do Canadians get to elect their head of state?
Well, that'll be the day. As soon as the Queen makes up her mind. But the those elections happened, and we actually have a newspaper edited by people who went to college who called the man a dictator. In the first paragraph of the Globe and Mail, he was called a dictator. Here he's the elected president. He defeated an honest-to-God candidate who didn't like him and went out to the people, and the people didn't vote for him. That's the way the ball bounces. But I'm glad we had that statement. That's what I'm going
to
say.
Phil, can I point out to our listeners that the website that we just took that from, and it's a very good website, has a very odd spelling. It's the words Venezuela analysis, except that the A at the end of Venezuela and the A at the beginning of analysis gets constricted into one A. So it's VenezuelaAnalysis.com.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if that helps, but thank you for trying. You know, thank goodness Google is smarter than the rest of us. All we have to do is just take a shot at it. Yeah. And they'll say, it's like going into a movie theater, right?
Because I tried to find it using normal spellings, and I had no luck.
Yeah. Just give up and say, please take me to my – going in a movie – going to the theater, and the guy says, come with me. And, it's B26-7A. Where? Well, now let's see. We've covered much of that.
Phil, you went to see Argo. I'm dying to hear your live review of.
Yes, this is a live review. This is not, it's worse than I actually thought. I mean, I knew it was somewhat insulting to Canada, but they go out of their way to be insulting. I hadn't realized that. Just to start it with the end of the film, they have a last scene where the characters are all laughing how they outsmarted the Iranians, and they use the Canadian embassy, and a CIA guy goes into the embassy, and he does all kinds of miracles, and it's actually absurd, by the way. Everything he does is basically absurd, but it happened. And so then at the end of the film, Alan Arkin, who the old left-wing folk singer, is playing this ignorant role of a guy who, he's one of the mockers, as they call them, you know, one of the guys who made it all work. And he's standing by a swimming pool doing a Hollywood scene. Hollywood loves itself. There's more and more movies about people who make movies, and they're all arrogant SOBs, and they're supposedly cute and funny. I don't really actually find him so. But Alan Arkin is supposed to be an American movie producer who works for the CIA. That I believe. So he says, guess what? I was at a restaurant this morning. And he said the waitress was reading the newspaper. And it said, Canadian caper. The Canadians save Americans. And she said, why can't we do something like that? And he said, I told her, Argo, F yourself. And then he and the other guy laughed because this is the CIA, because they did it all, you see. The Canadians actually hadn't done it. And the poor waitress was under the impression that the Canadians had done it. So now, the problem is, I hope that the Canadians, I wish they had not. I mean, incidentally, next time they come asking, just say, no, you remember the last time? And then you said you did that. So, don't ask. I don't know if we talked about it on this program, but it's Phil now and I, by the way, are co-hosting Friday morning at 9 o'clock. So if you heard it before, my apologies. New Zealand, the Parliament of New Zealand passed a resolution, unanimous, saying they did not appreciate the reference to New Zealand, which was highly insulting. But by the way, compared to the slap around and the cold shower given to Canada, I mean, we ought to apply for, like, refugee status. This is absurd. The New Zealanders, there's a brief reference. At the beginning of the film, the CIA people, of course, are getting ready to solve the world's problems, and they're rushing through buildings full of people and cursing to each other. And one of them says, well, what's happened to our six Americans who are in Tehran? And the guy said, well, the British turned them away, and the Kiwis didn't help, but the Canadians have taken them in. That's what he said. Kiwis turned them away. That was enough to get the whole New Zealand Parliament on its hind legs. And they passed a unanimous resolution which said that is an insult and affront to us because our representatives in Tehran risked their lives. They didn't have to. And they went way beyond the ordinary responsibilities of consular officials on their own, by the way, doing their decent thing, to help. So they called for an apology from Hollywood. Lots of luck. And now, the man who passed the resolution for the New Zealand Parliament, his name is Wilson, he said, I did that because our prime minister and our foreign minister are afraid of Hollywood. He didn't say Washington. He said they're afraid of Hollywood. You know, the Tolkien film got shot down there, right? So maybe they won't. So when they make the next one, maybe they'll have to do it in Arizona.
No kidding.
They have to pay. You know, have to teach New Zealand a lesson, I guess.
Big business in New Zealand, shooting fantasy movies. You know, it's a lot of unspoiled scenery there that they don't have in Arizona, by the way.
Yeah. Well, maybe it'd be yes. Yeah. It's appalling. Work of people should appreciate. That's very important. I'm going to just review the known big elements in the film. The film is built around the conceit that the CIA guy has got this brilliant idea to create a fake film that they're going to make in Hollywood, he's going to give passports to the six Americans who will pose as Canadians involved in filmmaking. So it's all about how much fun that is to call up your CIA friends in Hollywood, which apparently there are tons of them, by the way, if I'm to understand Hollywood in this rendering. And then they agree, of course, to lie to the American people and lie to everybody else while they do this mock-up of a film. And then they go in and they pull off this big caper. Well, as Americans who were there, particularly Mr. Leszek, if you can check it out, go to Huffington Post, he said, well, of course, that's all very nice, but it didn't happen. The reason they were exiting the country safely was that they had Canadian passports. Those are real. They had real Canadian passports. and nobody asked them anything about a movie. None of them opened their little mouths about any movie. So Mr. Arkin and Mr. Goodman and all that other stuff had nothing to do with it. It was not necessary. And by the way, Ken Taylor, who was the Canadian ambassador, he said, to this day, I believe we could have gotten them out without all that fuss. And he actually, and grown-up political people and people who have self-respect, and particularly governments, say you're not really supposed to allow a foreign intelligence agency to come into your embassy and organize things and to plan things. That's really not a good idea. It's you can be busted, as they say, for that. All this went on. Another detail that really ought to be reminded, incidentally, this works because the evil other has, of course, no voice, the Islamic Republic, nor the people of Iran, who are all portrayed as maniacal and fools. And Roger Ebert, you know, people have respect for this guy. He gave it 5 stars. He wanted to give it 12 stars, but he was looking, you know, because he said it was so much fun that they, you know, why are people worried about the accuracy? We fooled the Iranians. That's all you need to know. Well, actually, there's no evidence that they fooled them. Because anybody who reads a history book will be able to tell you something. 1979 was a very revolutionary time in Iran, where political groupings were fighting each other for control of the government. The occupation of the Iranian of the U.S. embassy in Iran led to the fall of a government. The Bazargan government fell within 2 days because Bazargan realized that he couldn't control those students. Students were taking over the embassy because Jimmy Carter had agreed to allow the Shah to come to the United States, even though the world had already proclaimed that this guy, the Shah, had pretty much run out his string, that he was indeed a robber and a killer, in the sense that his state was about as nasty as you could get. And it worked very hand in glove with the British and Americans. So he was one of those guys you want to retire somewhere, but not to the U.S. because the Iranian population was inflamed. So those students took over the embassy. The government fell. And the people who were emerging, young people like Bani Sadr and Gobsadar, were two big names of the time. Neither are any longer in business. They did not agree with the students. Now, they're the ones with state power. They're the ones who are beginning to govern and try to cope with the problem of students who are challenging not only Washington, but are challenging them. So they did not want the students to keep those hostages. They wanted to get that out of the way. Mr. Bazargan said it. I mean, we don't want this headache. It was a headache for everybody. So they weren't searching. That's a myth. I haven't seen anybody demonstrate that the Iranians cared about those the six. They had a problem with the 50. And by the way, even if you were one of those, like if you read the memoirs, and some of the students have written memoirs, 50 people is a lot of people to look after. So 56 would be a lot more. So the anxiety, the idea that they were searching, that's not true. In the middle of the film, they have this thing where the students are looking for photographs of the six. Well, they didn't know. That's bunk. That wasn't part of this. So they've created a false story and gotten themselves all excited about it. And it is very injurious, but not just it's to Canada, to the British. Anybody gets in the way of the CIA's reputation. The book, by the way, by the guy who written as told to book by Argo, the CIA man, Mr. Mendez, he clearly has an animus towards Ken Taylor. He is injured. He wants, and the CIA wanted. He said he didn't intend to do the book, but CIA told him to do the book. And basically, the point of the book was to say, we did that. It wasn't the Canadians. Well, if it wasn't, whose embassy was it? Was that your embassy? By the way, whose passports were they? Were those your passports? No. Those were the two things that helped those six, the embassy and the passports. And Mr. Mendez can jump up and down. He can write on his own back. He can do whatever he wants. But he cannot undo that. But the CIA seemed to want to get the, you know, to take the credit back. So they make this film. Incidentally, have you, by the way, Phil, you saw the film Wag the Dog?
Yes.
It, this rips off Wag the Dogs in many ways. When they recruit Alan Arkin to the big producer, to, they have a Wag the Dog scene. You remember in Wag the Dog, you have to go see the producer, right?
Yes.
And the producer tells you how to do it. So that's what this guy does. So it's kind of like Wag the Dog, except it's not as funny, because Wag the Dog is making a great point. In Wag the Dog, they're trying to expose that kind of weirdness, and you might call the Dr. Strangelove aspect of American politics, military, and culture. But in this one, actually, they're celebrating it. I don't know what the answer to the question is about who Mr. Mendez's friends are in Hollywood, but I'm really struck by the fact that nobody cares. I mean, where's all of our reporters, even, say, left-wing reporters? Don't they care? There are people there that are contract workers, and then there are some who just happily volunteer to work for a secret agency, which may or may not be doing a good deed. It's not automatic if a guy said, you know, come here, I'm working for the CIA. I want you to carry this box over here. Well, why would you do that? You don't know what's in that box. You didn't vote for anybody's policy. You know, why are you, is people want to be volunteer police? Police, you say, look, if you're in the CIA, that's your problem. So you do that. But these are people who are enamored or just enthralled with the idea. It's kind of like we used to have this counselor in Toronto who used to want to ride around in police cars so he could play with a siren and get out at night with a flashlight and talk to people. There are people who get a little dumb, a little sick in the head, you know. It's a cultural issue. But it Argo really shows that. I think we're getting kind of a tipping point here where more and more films are CIA-based, written by the CIA, about the CIA, and then at the end of it, they pose with movie stars. And you say, you guys are, you know, ought to all get back to work, you know. It's not a healthy point. It's, what is that, Zero Dark 30, and where, you know, torture is okay because now we have a woman who leads us. So if a woman says torture him, you know, it must be okay. It's rather strange. Anyhow, the film is, in that sense, much worse. And I would like to see the Canadian Parliament say, let's review what happened. Let's call Ken Taylor, by the way, and say, what did you do there? And by the way, don't do it next time, okay? Because these guys don't appreciate nothing. They will play games with you. I mean, the president's wife gave that film the award. It was her. You know, and as somebody said, it couldn't have been a mystery. It was... They must have known who was going to get it because you think she would have given that to Django? No, it was going to be this one, and they knew. Not a pretty thing to watch. You've been listening to the Taylor Report. Check us out, taylor-report.com. Write to us, taylor@ciut.fm. And Terry and Phil, thank you very, very much. And this is Phil Taylor with Taylor Report. See you next week.